Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. In the evolving field of trauma therapy, we're increasingly recognizing that healing isn't just about processing memories or changing thought patterns. The application of the biology of trauma lens is that it is just as much about addressing the impact trauma has had on our biology, which now keeps us stuck in our trauma responses. One crucial aspect of this biological impact is brain inflammation. It is one of the most common, yet most overlooked, gatekeepers of trauma healing. Brain inflammation creates many of the symptoms that people attach to their trauma responses, yet often is what is triggering those trauma responses. Yes, you heard me right. It's not just people and places that can trigger our trauma response. It is also a specific immune cell in our brain, microglia. How does brain inflammation hold us back in fog and fatigue? And what can we do? To help answer that question and share brain inflammation with you is my guest, Dr. Austin Perlmutter, a board-certified internal medicine physician, New York Times bestselling author, published researcher, and now the executive director for Big Bold Health, a food as medicine company focused on helping people rejuvenate health through better immune function. In this episode, you will learn why good insights from therapy seem to fade by the next day. Small stresses feel overwhelming to our brain. Why what we eat affects how well we can process emotions. Relationship conflicts leave us mentally exhausted. Why our diet can dysregulate us just as much as our partner. And why our mind feels clearer in nature, sometimes more than in a therapy session. Whether you are working with your own trauma responses or are a professional helping others, it's time to understand brain inflammation and its crucial role on the healing journey. I'm so very excited for this episode. Let's get started. So thank you so much for your work, first of all, on connecting brain health with the immune system. This is, I feel like, the untapped area of medicine that needs to be tapped into. So if you could explain this connection between the immune system, our immune health, and brain health, let's start there.
Yeah, well, I'd like to begin by drawing attention to one of the more pervasive myths as it relates to brain health and mental health, which is that somehow what happens in the body doesn't affect what happens in the brain, that we have a mind that exists somewhere off in the ether, and then we have a body that exists here in our biology. And the truth of the matter is that our brains are biological systems and that mental health issues, just as cognitive health issues, are a reflection of our brain state. To that end, all of the major systems that exist within our body, so that would be our metabolic health, our endocrine system, and our immune system, impact our brain health. And to really drive this point home, 10% of the cells in your brain are immune cells. They are by definition immune cells. But beyond that, the majority of the cells in your brain participate in immune conversations. So neurons have receptors for immune signals. Neurons can produce immune signals. And the other glial cells in your brain, so astrocytes and oligodendrocytes, are also involved in this immune conversation. What does that mean for the average person in the context of brain issues that we might want to talk about? Well, what it means is that your brain is being constantly fine-tuned as a reflection of what happens in your environment. And one of the ways that that happens is through the immune system. So let me give an example that I think most people will be familiar with, which is how we feel when we're sick. So last time you had a flu, a cold, or were otherwise just unwell, how was your thinking? How was your mood? You know, for the average person, and I'm including myself in this, you feel a little bit off. You might feel brain fog. You might feel low energy. You might feel like you don't want to go to that birthday celebration. You might feel like you don't want to sit down and do your taxes. And the reason for this, based on the best understanding of what's happening in our brain, is that it's the immune activation, specifically inflammation, that seems to change the way that we think and feel. So this is really important because now we've gone from saying, well, the mind exists out here and the body exists down here, to saying the brain and the body are integrated by biology. And one of the ways in which that biology is being changed by our environment, by the things that happen to us as a reflection of our interactions with the world, is through the immune system, for better and for worse.
We talk a lot about the microglia here in the biology of trauma. And we talk a lot about how inflammation in the brain and kind of, you know, unleashed by the activated microglia are part of the trauma response in the body that leads to the brain fog, the decision fatigue, all of these things that you're mentioning. And what you wrote an article 2 years ago now relating, connecting the COVID infection with depression, but it's not just COVID. It really is, would be a lot of viral infections. It would be a lot of infections in the body that then would cause this stimulation, this activation of the immune system pathway in the brain. Is that right?
That's right. And I think another key point that people should understand is that as it relates to how, let's say, inflammation in the brain can be activated. So you brought up these activated microglial cells. It's not just through infections, but it may be through infections in some ways. So we had this instance of this COVID-19 pandemic, and you know, people have a lot of different opinions on exactly what's happening with that, what it does to the body. I think if we can agree that certain people were negatively affected by the virus itself, and that many of these people, statistically speaking, have brain issues. Many of them now we know long COVID type symptoms, which is brain fog, mental health issues, trouble focusing, trouble concentrating. You know, one of the core pathways that has been proposed is basically brain inflammatory activation that leads to, through what we just described as it relates to kind of what happens when we're sick, a chronic activation of the brain's microglial cells. And the output of that is that we don't think as well, we don't feel as well. But the other piece of this, which is so important to understand, is that brain immune activation could be a convergent pathway, meaning that you can still get brain immune activation even if you're not exposed to something infectious. And the best example there might be that if you think about what you consume in a given day that might impact your brain function, there's a lot of people talking about food. Food is obviously very important, but the majority of the bits of content that go into your brain are coming in through your eyes and through your ears and are activating the stress pathways in the brain, which we know well, chronic stress within the body is a pro-inflammatory signal. So the idea here is if activated microglia, if brain immune activation in general is linked to mental health conditions, is linked to thinking less clearly, then we need to worry about, well, what are the things that are activating our brain's immune state? And certainly we can be thinking about an infection. That's kind of the easy answer. Also, we can be thinking about diet, the gut-brain connection. That's kind of the next stage as far as making that link. But we also need to be thinking about the digital content and the conversations that we're having, because through, again, this chronic stress pathway, this could be also activating those brain immune signals. So it's basically trying to get to the idea that the immune system is not just an infectious response, but rather is a signaling system that within our brain is likely one of the principal drivers of how we think and how we feel. The positive side of this, of course, is that it's not all these negative inputs. There are things that we can do by way of modulating our inputs to potentially improve the health of our brain's immune system.
And when this inflammation happens, when this inflammatory pathway gets started in the brain, what does that do to neuroplasticity specifically?
Yeah, what a good question. Well, when we think about neuroplasticity, you know, it can be described at a number of different levels. Usually what we're talking about is the strength of the connections between neurons, what we call the synapse. And there's thousands or trillions of these synapses throughout the brain. I was going to say thousands of billions, but that's not quite as helpful. So you have trillions of synapses, kind of the connections between neurons, the connections between neurons and glial cells, connections between glial cells, and they can be stronger or they can be weaker, meaning that signals can be more likely to go through or less likely to go through. And so the kind of general postulate is neurons that fire together, wire together, meaning that when you activate certain pathways within your brain, it's more likely that they will continue to activate. So what we now understand is that issues with this neuroplasticity are linked to a wide variety of mental health and cognitive health outcomes. So everything from Alzheimer's disease to depression are linked to issues with neuroplasticity. So we really want to preserve healthy neuroplasticity. And at the level of the synapse, one of the things that's really interesting is that certain proteins produce growth factors within the brain, of which the best example is probably brain-derived neurotrophic factor, seem to drive a strengthening of neuroplasticity. But BDNF, this brain-derived neurotrophic factor, appears to be decreased, downregulated, both from a genetic expression perspective and the actual levels of the protein in the context of both stress and inflammation. So this is kind of an interesting connection whereby we start to see that the immune system could actually have a kind of suppressive effect on healthy neuroplasticity. One of the ways this could happen is through inflammatory cytokines. The other area that's important to understand is that microglial cells, again, the brain's kind of resident immune cells, play a kind of starring role in neuroplasticity, that they can actually go and remove the synapses based on some other immune proteins called complement. But the bottom line here is that inflammation specifically seems to be a damaging chronic effect on healthy neuroplasticity. So it's another reason to really prioritize overall immune health and especially brain immune health as one of the major ways that we may be able to preserve healthy brain function.
So I already want to just jump into it, and how do we do that? And what I would say that what we already stress around here is the importance of sleep. Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to give us the science behind sleep and this brain immune pathway and neuroplasticity.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting when you look at the connection between sleep and brain immunity. If you look at the research, you know, scientists have been trying to figure out why we sleep for really hundreds of years, but especially in the last decades. And in their search to find out why we sleep, they started looking at proteins in a bunch of animals, like a bunch of random animals. But what they found is that there was a molecule in the bloodstream that when injected into animals made them sleepy. And what was it? Well, it was a immune-related molecule. And so that's kind of led to where we're at now, which is we actually want a little bit of inflammation to make us sleepy. It may be that one of the reasons sleep originated was to help our bodies respond to perceived damage, perceived danger in the form of inflammation, which is super interesting. And it does speak to something else, which is inflammation is not a bad thing. It is actually a necessary thing. If we didn't have inflammation, we would die any given day because it's how we're able to fend off the crazy outside world that lives on and in us. So sleep seems to be both something that responds to inflammation and that modulates inflammation. So getting good sleep seems to help keep inflammation, keep immunity in a healthier state, whereas having higher levels of inflammation and being sick may actually increase sleepiness in certain cases. There's another piece here that I think is important. We're only, you know, more recently starting to understand how significant this is. It's really only discovered about a decade ago. But it's the idea that the brain has a system that drains out all the metabolic waste that builds up during the day. It's called the glymphatic system. And the idea here is, which hasn't quite been as vetted in kind of human research yet, that if you have a buildup of all of this gunk that kind of accumulates over the course of the day and sleep cleans out that gunk, which it does, it actually increases the flow of this glymphatic system, then not getting good sleep could lead to a kind of blockage of this gunk, which could, in theory, lead to an increased inflammatory response within the brain. I think the bottom line is sleep is well established to be about the most potent thing that a person can do to improve their brain function on a given day. And I'll stand by this. You know, food matters, exercise matters, all of these things make a difference. Sleep is the most significant as it relates to seeing changes in brain activation and people objectively being able to say something is different. So I think sleep is super important for a whole range of reasons. And there's a reason why when we're sick, we're sleepier. Sleep helps our bodies to recover from an immune threat or just a threat in general. There's some correlates here to say, well, what about people who sleep a lot? They actually may have higher levels of inflammation. And one of the reasons for that may be the driver of why people are sleeping a lot. So if you're sleeping a lot because you have obstructive sleep apnea and you're not getting good rest or you have another medical condition, these may be things that are independently associated with higher levels of inflammation. So there's some kind of confounding there. But I do believe that getting good sleep is about the best thing a person can do to optimize their brain in the shortest amount of time.
Austin, which is why this year I have made sleep be a non-negotiable for me.
I like it.
Because I have come to the same conclusion, just based on my personal experience as well, that everything else that I do is awesome and helpful, but sleep is the biggest game changer for me, for my brain health. And so for this year, it's my non-negotiable.
That's fantastic.
Now, before we go on to the others, as you're talking about the metabolic waste that accumulates, it makes me think of epigenetics and how that can then start to actually change our DNA as waste starts to accumulate even in our nucleus. Can you bring in the epigenetics to this brain inflammation pathway quickly?
Yeah. So I think as it relates to epigenetics on the whole, and I mean, I guess you probably go into the basics of this in other conversations, you know, the question is, how does epigenetics specifically relate to our brain function? And where I've been focusing my attention recently is the question of how is it that certain experiences leave such significant marks on our psychological state that can last for decades, potentially the rest of our lives? Because if you try to understand what processes within our brains could sustain that level of change, it pretty quickly narrows down to just a couple of things. So it's one thing to say, oh, you have some inflammation in your brain, and the inflammation's making you feel funky, making you feel withdrawn. But unless that inflammation is sustained for years, you don't really have a good explanation as to why you maintain that level of mood, maintain that level of kind of feeling withdrawn. So epigenetics provides one potential solution as to why certain events in our lives carry forward this psychological state that seems to last beyond, way beyond when the actual event is over. The other way in which I'm looking at this is actually a little bit of a pivot here, but I'm going to go there. In trying to understand how certain therapeutics may have a positive effect on brain function, and specifically, I'm working with a group to look at how this may apply to psychedelic molecules. The reason there being, if you look at some of these studies, for example, looking at psilocybin, where one dose lasted people for multiple years as far as remission from mental health issues and providing kind of benefits to their mental state, it doesn't necessarily seem that either a little neuroplastic boost, because we can look at the duration of some of those effects with those molecules, or an immune change, or even alterations to the HPA axis could sustain that level of kind of benefit. So it all leads us to this question of what is happening potentially epigenetically as it relates to our DNA expression within the brains. I think where there's some kind of very preclinical research is to understand how epigenetics may specifically happen within immune cells as a reflection of what happens in our environment. So if you look at certain nutrients, there's some signal that, you know, for example, polyphenols, which are a dietary nutrient found in plants, may have epigenetic impacts. We're actually doing that research right now with a group I'm with called Big Bold Health. But really where I go right now is, yes, there's some cell research suggesting that there are these interactions between these different systems, between our life experiences and epigenetics in the brain. But it's still more interesting to consider this question of, we don't quite know why certain things that happen in our lives can last so long from a psychological, from a cognitive perspective. And epigenetics, to me, provides kind of the most, the best overall answer to that question. Am I sure that that is the case? No, I'm not. But it does seem like the mechanisms fit with the timeline that we're seeing.
And I think it's exciting that the research seems to be getting closer to actually establishing a mechanism that is research-based, that is science, not just, well, it, you know, trauma causes psychological effects and they just stick with you forever. But actually understanding the mechanism, I think that we're getting so much closer to understanding that from a science perspective, which is really exciting.
Absolutely. And there's something incredibly empowering about the idea that how we feel these kind of deep scars in our psyche may actually be a representation of whatever you want to call it, acetylation, methylation. But the point being, there's a biological correlate there that can be targeted through an intervention that we could say, we're kind of going to go do some microsurgery on your epigenetic state and, you know, remove some of these methyl or acetylation groups. And in doing so, the more important thing there is, you know, who cares about carbons? What people care about is how they feel. And if this is the pathway to getting that to a better place, then it seems a no-brainer that we should be targeting it.
Mm-hmm. It is empowering to have more and more tools. So let's talk about two more things. Let's talk about diet, and then let's talk about nature. And so let's just talk about the role of diet on the brain inflammation pathway. I know that's a huge topic.
Yeah. If you think about in a given day, what are the decisions that a person would make that would impact their overall physiology? There are really only a few things. And as it relates to physically changing their architecture, it's diet, because the molecules that make up your brain don't just come out of thin air. They are basically synthesized through what you consume through your food. I mean, that means that you are building your brain with the food that you consume. So obviously you want quality building blocks if you want a quality brain. Your neurotransmitters are either synthesized or kind of created from certain molecules that come through your diet. The impact of diet on neuroplasticity by way of things like inflammation is pretty well established. So diet matters mechanistically for all the reasons that one would expect. There's basically no pathway in the brain that wouldn't be altered, again, mechanistically by the food we eat. And I alluded to this earlier, but this kind of gut-brain connection whereby the state of our gut, so that includes our gut cells, our gut immune cells, our microbiome, is impacting our brain by way of things like the vagus nerve and also by way of things like short-chain fatty acids, which are metabolic byproducts of gut bacteria, all of which can, so the short-chain fatty acids and immune cells can produce molecules that go into the bloodstream, impact the brain, and so on and so forth. So hopefully that's enough to get people at least interested. If you look at kind of population-based epidemiological research, you see that people who eat certain types of diet tend to have better mental health, better cognitive health, live longer, have lower levels of inflammation. So all of these things are, at another level, good reason to choose, I would argue, a healthier diet. And then there's some data coming out as far as interventional studies for certain types of diet and certain brain states. I will just kind of caution that there's a tendency to overblow the level of kind of interventional research in nutrition as it relates to brain health. I mean, I think there's a feeling that you can cure any brain disorder by making changes to your diet. And while that may be the case for certain people, we just don't have enough research to say that for the average person, getting on this really really specific diet is known to lead to a certain output. And example here would be something like, oh, get on the ketogenic diet and it's going to fix depression. Well, maybe, but do we have that as far as good research and randomized trials? Not really. So from my perspective, I would say that most dietary advice that people will read about tends to be sensationalized and really not all that helpful because it's usually tethered to trying to sell something. The best research that I have seen is that for most people, as it relates to brain health outcomes, and specifically I'm talking about where I've seen the best research around depression, around cognitive health, it's a little bit different around things like stroke and other brain conditions, is basically avoiding ultra-processed foods and eating a diversity of whole foods, a lot of plant foods, some whole grains, more poultry, more fish, and less red meat. Now, you could argue the details of it, the nuance of it. Do I think that a grass-fed or pastured cow is different from a feedlot cow? I really do. But as you're looking at the general recommendations as far as what has been shown in an interventional study or in population-based studies, it's that avoiding ultra-processed food is a good plan, which means cutting out added sugar, cutting out things in your diet that you don't know what they are because they're on the ingredient list and you don't know the chemical structure of tetrabenazoate or whatever else is in there. And it's eating a diversity of kind of whole foods, which includes plants, can include animal proteins if you are eating animal products. And I will just say, if you're not, there's decent evidence that if you are a vegan, you should look at least supplementing with omega-3s, B12, and potentially some additional elements. But that's my high-level diet. So I'd say diet matters from a mechanistic perspective, diet matters from an epidemiological perspective, and now diet matters from an interventional perspective for these conditions. So we need to be paying attention to it. But instead of going directly to, well, it has to be this extreme diet I saw on social media, which is a 20-day juice cleanse for brain health, stick to the basics because that's where the evidence tends to be strongest. And also try not to get sucked into the sensationalism and diet wars that are everywhere right now. So that's the diet piece.
Yeah, thank you for that. And this is so true because for those people who are dealing with how trauma has changed their biology, they're also dealing with mitochondrial issues. They're also dealing with detoxification issues. And so changing their diet in an extreme way can also trigger a lot of other things and cause some serious imbalances in their biology. They're just not ready to support some of the more aggressive dietary interventions. And so just approaching it with wisdom is very much aligned with what we would like people to do.
Well, let me just say one other thing about that, because I think there's a the obvious truth is that everyone's biology is different. Some people do need more aggressive dietary change. You know, some people may benefit from a ketogenic diet, but the problem is these things are put forth as blanket statements, which is that everyone needs this. And when you ask, well, what's your research to support this? It's usually, well, a cell study or an observational trial with 10 people. And the issue here is that when you look at statistically what happens to people who are trying to make lifestyle changes, and the best example here is the New Year's resolution, it's that people tend to believe that the only thing they need is a plan and willpower, and they will be able to follow through with this thing. So whether it's the Atkins, paleo, keto, whatever choose your poison diet it is, the more extreme the diet, the less likely you'll be able to stick to it. Same with an exercise routine. If you have a 5K a day goal and you've never run before January 1st, the chances you stick to that are almost zero. So I am all about habit change and sustainability, which means that you don't have to change everything at once. And as you're trying to make these changes for your diet, celebrate the little things and start small. Where I usually tell people to start is try to reduce added sugar. It's pretty much universal that, especially in sugary sweetened beverages, whether you're a conventional doctor, an integrative doctor, the World Health Organization, the CDC, everyone recommends to decrease intake of added sugar. That is not sensationalized, and it's also not controversial. And yet, the default is, for the average American, 50 plus pounds of added sugar a year. So there's a huge opportunity for positive change that can be very specific and can be very implemented in a given day.
I love that. A great place to start. Start cutting out the sugar. Sleep more. And then let's talk about nature.
Let's do it.
I'm super curious, but also I've already seen this effect so much in the people who come to my program that they talk about how much more focused and calm they are when they get time in nature. So what's the science behind it, Austin?
Right. Well, when I think about the best interventions for human health and specifically for cognitive and mental health, I like to think about where does the research show a statistically significant benefit and what are things that are accessible to the average person. So, you know, maybe cryotherapy is beneficial, but who can afford a cryo chamber in their living room? So nature exposure turns out to have some good research to support it, and it tends to be readily accessible, often free. So what does the literature say about this? You know, in the United States, we've started to investigate the impact of nature exposure on our overall health. But in Japan, they've been looking at this for multiple decades. It is called their Shinrin-yoku, which is basically the science of forest bathing. The idea here being that just being out in nature, not having an agenda, you don't have to sit and meditate for 30 minutes under a tree. Just being out in nature, being mindful in nature has health benefits. And one of the most consistent signals that's been seen from this type of research, which is basically having people go and be in nature as opposed to an kind of urban environment, is a decrease in stress markers. So both subjective stress and physiological markers of stress like cortisol. And one study that I like to cite was a US study done in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where they had people go and basically be in urban natural settings. So we're not talking Yosemite, we're talking just kind of a city park for 20 minutes. And they found it was enough to lower people's salivary cortisol. And so that was once a week, an intervention that was statistically shown to benefit people's stress markers. And you see this kind of more generally with a bunch of other correlates of stress. So for example, lower systolic blood pressure, for example, better heart rate variability, as well as people experiencing kind of subjective benefits to their mental health when they're in nature. So there's lots of other research we could talk about. There's brain imaging studies, there's research on rumination, there's research on kind of overall quality of life. But the bottom line I would put forth to people is, as you're looking at things that you can easily incorporate into a given day, getting a dose of vitamin N seems to be the no-brainer here. And yes, I do understand that there are places that going outside is not super practical for certain seasons. And to that end, I would say there is some research suggesting a benefit from indoor plants. And so starting with just getting an indoor plant or two, you know, there's also some, you know, something to say about caring for something, even as small as a plant. But having an indoor plant may give some of those benefits, because, you know, in some research they've actually shown that looking at digital pictures of nature compared to digital pictures of cityscapes is linked to better brain outputs. And in this case that I'm describing, people made more future-oriented decisions when they looked at naturescapes versus cityscapes. So having a plant in your home is another cost-effective way, specifically if you get a snake plant, which is kind of my go-to recommendation, because I don't have the best green thumb. So it's a little disheartening when your plants pass away early. So snake plants, very resilient. It's a nice way to bring some green into your home.
I love it, Austin. So in summary for people, we've got sleep, we've got diet, we've got nature as tools that they can use that are accessible for everyone in order to help improve their brain inflammation pathway and the healthy neuroplasticity. If they could only change one, we would bring in the sleep first. If we could only change one thing about the diet, we would start with cutting out the sugar. With the nature, at least get a snake plant in your home. But even go
I
to
don't a, have a stock in snake plants. Just
even just going to a city park once a week
exactly
would be good enough. So did I get the order right of how you would prioritize this for people?
That's it. Yeah, I love it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. If you would like to know more about brain inflammation, and I hope you do for how much it has changed my life and healing journey, then I have resources for you, my friend. In the show notes, I will have links to several resources for you. One of them will be a guide to the three most common biochemical imbalances that I find in those stuck on their trauma healing journey. This is an important guide for me because if you know my story, I had all three and they definitely had me stuck in my trauma responses. And a few of them were contributing to my brain inflammation. So in this guide, I have the common traits for each of the biochemical imbalances so you know if testing would be helpful and how to do testing if you want to. I also have put together a brain inflammation video library over the years. This is where I've put all of the videos on how to recognize brain inflammation, what to do about brain inflammation, This is when testing is not helpful, but there's so much that we can do. And if this is information that would help you and resource you, well, then I hope you will check out my Brain Inflammation Video Library. There are a few related podcast episodes I want to bring your attention to. In fact, episode number 2 was on the long-term effects of brain inflammation. I had guest Dr. Peter Kahn for that one. Episode 27 was explaining how does brain fog and inflammation affect somatic work. And episode 29 is a review on the physiology and biology of the trauma response that I referenced in this episode, but didn't have time to go into. Now, if you are wanting to calm that brain inflammation, I want to share with you one of the supplements that I take. This is magnesium trinate. It is known as the magnesium that is best supportive of our neurons and best crosses the blood-brain barrier. This is a specific form of magnesium, and I take 400 milligrams daily in order to support and keep my brain inflammation calm. And again, I'll have the link to the specific magnesium trinate that I take. If you want more information, you can also check out my YouTube channel where I have 2 videos specifically on brain inflammation. I'll have those links there in the show notes. One is on the science of brain inflammation and the other is the top supplement for brain inflammation. As a reminder, I am here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the trauma healing journey. So take a moment to subscribe or leave a review if you've already subscribed. Your reviews and feedback are how I know how to improve this podcast, bring you great content, and help you find information that will change your life. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Until next episode, lots of love.